Today is Wednesday, April 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the billionaire CEO of Facebook is grilled by U.S. lawmakers about privacy policy.
If you and other social media companies do not get your act in order, none of us are going to have any privacy anymore.
Russia votes against an independent investigation into a chemical attack in Syria. President Trump fumes over the FBI raid of his attorney. Also ahead, Congo's artists struggle for recognition. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. lawmakers Tuesday demanded better personal data protection at Facebook, whose CEO Mark Zuckerberg weathered heated questions from two Senate panels over data breaches affecting tens of millions of users of the mammoth social media platform. Senator Bill Nelson, the ranking Democrat on the Commerce Committee, addressed that issue forcefully.
And why didn't Facebook notify 87 million users that their personally identifiable information had been taken?
Zuckerberg fended off questions from U.S. senators on how the world's largest social media network might be regulated more closely, and he repeated apologies that he made on Monday for a range of problems that have beset Facebook, from data privacy to foreign attempts to influence U.S. elections. But the 33-year-old internet mogul managed to deter any specific talk about new laws.
To make sure no other app developers out there are misusing data, we're now investigating every single app that had access to a large amount of information in the past. And if we find that someone improperly used data, we're going to ban them from Facebook and tell everyone affected.
Joining us now for more on the hearing on Tuesday, VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. She was on Capitol Hill for most of it. Catherine, what was your biggest takeaway from the hearing?
Well, what I take away from it is that senators were incredibly interested in finally getting Mark Zuckerberg up on the Hill. This is the first time that they've had him for congressional testimony, and they have him on a very big issue of internet privacy, this Cambridge Analytica scandal, which just seems to be getting bigger and bigger, and they really wanted to drill down with him on what exactly the company did to safeguard that, and once they knew that this had happened, how did they react to it? What I came away with after hours and hours of hearings is that Facebook realizes that it really dropped the ball on this and that they need to do much, much better, and that the U.S. Congress is actually going to keep an eye on them from here on out. You know, internet privacy, even though it's something of a bipartisan issue here in Washington, has not gotten a lot of traction up until now. There's some legislation floating around, but it's never really gotten to the point where it could be passed. We might see that happen now after Mark Zuckerberg.
Do you think that lawmakers got the questions they wanted answered?
Oh, yes. As we have in any congressional hearing, there was an element of theater. You know, you had that packed room, and because this was two Senate committees, you had double the number of senators asking questions. You had almost half of the U.S. Senate in that room with Mark Zuckerberg. So that's part of why today's testimony took so long. And also, senators wanted to get in on this hot-button issue of election security, internet security, and privacy.
All right, that's VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Thanks for the update. President Donald Trump was fuming on Tuesday over raids by the Federal Bureau of Investigation of his lawyer's office and home in search of details about possible ties between Trump and two women who they say had sex with him. The latest turn of events in a wide-ranging probe that Trump has called a witch hunt, has moved investigators deeper into the president's inner circle of advisors and cast a pall of uncertainty over the White House. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham weighed in on the president's anger.
I don't think what Mueller is doing is a witch hunt. There are a lot of guidelines in place before you can go into an attorney's office. I'm sure this was well vetted. Most likely this has got more to do with Cohen than Trump. If it had anything to do with Russia, I doubt if Mueller would have outsourced it. I don't know. I want to make sure Mueller can do his job without political interference. We'll see where this goes.
Well, the raids on attorney Michael Cohen represent a dramatic escalation of a federal inquiry led by special counsel Mueller into alleged Russian meddling into the 2016 U.S. election. in light of concerns the president might fight Mueller, Democratic Senator Charles Schumer had this to say.
If the president is thinking of using this raid to fire Special Counsel Mueller or otherwise interfere with the chain of command in the Russia probe, we have one simple message for him. Don't even think about it.
Well, a source familiar with the matter said agents were looking in Monday's raids for information on payments to adult film star Stormy Daniels and former Playboy model Karen McDougal. Joining us to discuss these developments is Ron Hosko, a former assistant director for the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the current president of the Law Enforcement Defense Fund. Sir, why this dramatic step by FBI officials?
My supposition is that Mr. Cohen perhaps was involved in some form of bank fraud in relation to, you know, borrowing money, and presumably that was to make some or all of this $130,000 hush money payment, non-disclosure agreement payment to Stormy Daniels. If that is so, my supposition would be that perhaps Mr. Cohen made representations to a bank to take the loan or loans, and that those were perhaps false representations, that maybe he stated that the purpose of the loans was home improvement, to buy a new car, to engage in some other purpose. And when you're borrowing money from a bank, You're very often under a written obligation. It says it right at the bottom of some of the forms that there's an expectation that your statements to the bank are going to be truthful and accurate in all respects, that you're providing materially accurate information. And to not do so could result in charges of bank fraud. This could be reflective of a desire by Bob Mueller and or the FBI to squeeze Mr. Cohen in a way that says, look, you know, we have you in the commission of a felony. You're going to lose your law license. The financial impact is going to be great. Why don't you come along with us? Why don't you cooperate with us and tell us more about your relationship with Stormy Daniels and what the president knew? And so it could have a significant impact, certainly financially, on a practicing lawyer. We don't know the scope of what he knows, but in the FBI and the prosecutor's eye, they're always looking for cooperation. They're always looking for witnesses who will tell them more about other potential subjects. And here we're talking about the president of the United States. So were Mr. Cohen to cooperate, who knows the scope of what he might be willing to share if he was properly motivated.
How unusual would it be for the FBI to actually unannounced literally come in without notice and go to the trouble to do this without warning or just asking for the information? Would it be there's a risk that the evidence could be destroyed?
Sure. And so that's a risk that both the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office is compelled to weigh. They are, in many of their cases, acting as risk managers. And the risk is just what you're suggesting. What's the risk if we hand him a subpoena that he won't comply, or worse, that he will either hide, conceal, or destroy evidence that we think he has and that we need for our case? So they are really compelled to evaluate that in a couple of ways. One, the FBI's domestic investigative and operations guide expects that FBI agents are looking to use what's regarded as the least intrusive means to get the information that they seek and that they need. And in my estimation, there's no way that the FBI director and Rod Rosenstein and the Attorney General of the United States didn't know that this was going to occur. This is a sensitive matter involving somebody very closely tied to the president. So very high-level folks within the department are going to be aware of and certainly anticipating the backlash from a president who has lashed out before.
The president didn't mince words about his displeasure about the whole situation on Monday, really taking aim at the FBI, the Justice Department, the Attorney General, you name it. What is your reaction to that?
It's certainly a bit ironic because these are all people he selected himself. Sessions, Christopher Wray, Rod Rosenstein was his deputy attorney general, nominated by his administration, and the same with the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. So I guess to the president, he feels like his own people have somehow turned against him to engage in this reckless pursuit of collusion, alleged collusion, which he insists is not there. But, you know, I look at it differently. I'm looking at people who raised their right hand and swore an oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. And I think that the notion of these people, Rod Rosenstein, who I've met in the past and worked with a little bit, Jeff Sessions, who I've met more recently, Chris Wray, who I've heard nothing but positive things about. These are folks who took an oath to be dedicated public servants. And I think they are looking very seriously at the fact that we haven't seen. We haven't yet had the opportunity to examine, but they understand the seriousness of their charge, and I think they understand that they have an angry president who, whether he truly believes it's a witch hunt or whether he truly knows that he's done something wrong or someone close to him has, and Bob Mueller and his investigators are getting closer, and that is making the president more uncomfortable by the day. I do believe that what you have here is dedicated public servants out there who feel like they're doing the job that they were sent to do, that they will do that job till their last day in their position. These are thoughtful, serious-minded public servants who are sent to do a mission, and they're going to do that till their last day in the job.
That's Ron Hosko, former assistant director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation and current president of the Law Enforcement Defense Fund. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. President Trump applauds Qatar's efforts to stop funding terrorism. U.S. lifts a travel ban on Chad citizens. The nuclear deal could increase a risk for North Korean defectors. And Sesame Street is helping kids in the Mideast affected by war. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The United States on Tuesday consulted with allies in preparation for possible expanded military action in Syria following the latest suspected deadly chemical weapons attack on a Russian-held village, or rebel-held village, I should say. President Trump has warned that those responsible will pay a big price for Saturday's attack in eastern Ghouta that killed at least 40 people, although there is no conclusive evidence about what agent was used and who carried it out. Trump has spoken repeatedly with his British and French counterparts about a possible response to the attack. At the UN Security Council on Tuesday, Russia vetoed a U.S. draft resolution that would have set up a commission to investigate and assign blame for the weapons attack or the chemical weapons attack. U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley said the United States went the extra mile to get Russian support for the resolution to ensure that a new investigative body would be impartial, independent, and professional.
The record will not be kind to one permanent member of this council. Unfortunately, Russia has chosen the Assad regime again over the unity of this council. We have said it before that Russia will stop at nothing to shield the Assad regime.
As the U.S. mulled its response, the White House said Trump canceled a trip to Latin America, which was supposed to begin Friday, so he could oversee the American response to Syria. Joining us to discuss what might come next is former U.S. ambassador and currently the CEO of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter. What do you make of Russia refusing to go along with an independent investigation?
It's pretty harsh. And what it means is the Russians are, logic would say, they are either complicit or it is so important to them to defend Assad that they don't care what kind of, you know, what kind of bad PR they take.
Where does this leave the situation when most of the world sees this atrocity as something that just can't be continued, can't be something that's overlooked?
Well, I think what will happen is it's very hard to imagine that the president, having gotten all kinds of good credit a year ago when he sent a cruise missile strike into Syria after a chemical weapons attack, it's very hard for me to imagine the president won't do something. They were waiting for the vote in the UN. They've got their vote in the UN now. And that might have forestalled an attack had there been an agreement to do an investigation. But I think now an attack is much more likely. The question there is, you know, what do you attack? Do you try to locate the people who did it and punish them, or do you try to punish the regime? Or, you know, do you do more than just going to do a one-off? Many of the people who are criticizing Trump are saying doing a one-off doesn't make it any less likely that this will happen again. The problem is that it's not just a question of a bad guy, Assad doing something and the international community, that is the Americans and say the French and the Brits, responding. As you've said, it's the Russians. It's a question of whether other goals come in and people like, let's say, the president or the national security advisor say, well, you don't have Assad unless you have his proxies and people like the Iranians. So what if the Israelis, the Americans, the Saudis, God knows who else, all decide that they're going to go after the real root of this problem, which is Assad and his allies. So there's a chance that one way to go at this, one result of this could be, whether or not that logic or that actual action holds, that there could be a widening of response to the Syrians and those people who support them. And that could be a very, very dangerous face-off.
French President Emmanuel Macron has been coming out pretty strongly on this as well. And, you know, he said, obviously, we want to try a diplomatic approach. How do you even approach this diplomatically at this point when there's such a disregard?
I would assume that what he was talking about was the UN Security Council.
Okay.
I don't know what other diplomatic approach you take, especially if you're a country like France, like the United States, that the two countries have drawn a red line saying there will be consequences if you use chemical weapons. The consequences could have been an investigation and an international condemnation or whatever. But without that, I don't know what else you can do diplomatically. You have to do something by force. And so the problem now with force is, what is the result you want to get? There's one thing that you have to act to show you can act. But what is the result you want to get? Do you want to cripple Assad? Do you want to just teach him a lesson? Do you want to go after the people who, you know, say the army base that they think did it, the Air Force base that they think did it? You know, what are you doing with that attack? And what do you mean to have? And this shows, in a broader sense, the difficulty that many people have identified of what is your long-term strategy in the region. If your strategy in the region is to overthrow Assad, which is what, you know, I think Obama announced in 2011, well, that hasn't happened. And if you do overthrow Assad, you're really poking the Russians in the eye and the Iranians in the eye. And so if you're not getting rid of Assad, the man who does this, what are you doing? So I think there's a lot of tactical and strategic and moral questions that whoever is planning what will happen next has to take into account. That's why everyone has, you know, a lot of nervousness about just what happens next.
What I'm hearing is that really there needs to be some sort of strategy and goal before any big decision is made. So the president said that the decision is going to be made within 24 to 48 hours. Is that sort of a timeline that's realistic in getting this all sorted out?
Well, it's very realistic if you want to just do something. I mean, America has the capacity to shoot cruise missiles. America has the capacity to send in fighter jets. There's all kinds of things America can do. But your point is the most important one. It's very hard to imagine that you can come up with a strategic and nuanced and long-term and sustained response in such a short time. And so if your goal is doing something for the sake of doing something, that's easy. But if your goal is trying to make something happen and then, first of all, you have to decide, what do you want to make happen? What is it that you want out of these things other than just kind of a spasm of showing that you're responding? Because if you really just give a spasm, it just shows you're responding, you're committing the same kind of political error that, say, Bill Clinton was accused of back in the 90s of shooting, you know, missiles at al-Qaeda bases in Afghanistan rather than doing something about terrorism. In other words, for two decades, people have been arguing about the idea of, when you respond to bad behavior by just doing a demonstration that you can shoot missiles, does that get you anywhere? And this gets to that core question. If you don't know what you want, if you don't have a strategy to do something, to see a future over the horizon, what is the effort that you're going to make going to get you? Hard to say.
All right, that's former U.S. Ambassador and currently CEO of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA. This week, we discuss the various tactics that the Kremlin uses to wage political warfare in Western democracies and how to combat it with Alina Polyakova, Senior Fellow for Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. That's Press Conference USA, this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now as we turn to what's happening in the world of social media, and we hear from VOA's Doug Bernard. Doug?
Well, as people, I think, are digesting what they heard from Mark Zuckerberg on the Hill today, his first day of testimony on the Hill. He'll also be there tomorrow as well. Lots of people sharing their thoughts about that FBI search warrant that was executed against Michael Cohen on Monday. That Mr. Cohen, of course, President Trump's personal attorney, and lots of people very unhappy about it. Lots of people thrilled about it. Let's just take a quick look at some of the social media tweets and posts and that kind of thing. Here's one to begin us off. Trump's response to the FBI's raid on Cohen's office and home. It's an attack on our country. It's an attack on all we stand for. No, it's an investigation. All this is just a way to make people back him if Mueller finds anything. With a dissenting point of view, here's this. Hashtag Mueller is the Russian. Cohen has done nothing wrong, just more of a witch hunt because Mueller has nothing. They are afraid the stage is set and Mueller is digging his own grave. Also in agreement here, the offices of Trump lawyer Michael Cohen have been raided by the FBI. The out-of-control agency, I assume the FBI, is still at it, trying to impede Trump at every turn. Too many Obama guys still in charge there. Here is a thought. Why the heck would Mueller go after Michael Cohen when he's cooperating with the investigation and producing requested documents? Mueller has clearly crossed a line. And one last one here for you here, just to kind of give a sense of this, a survey of what people are saying. If any are old enough to remember, due to stress of possible criminal indictment, President Nixon started to lose his sanity at the end. Mr. Trump displaying those same signs, paranoia, delusional thinking, nonsensical, and illogical language. So opinion really all over the board there. Not a big surprise, just given how fraught this whole Russia question and Russia investigation is.
All right, Doug, thank you. You can follow him on Twitter at DFrontiers. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE.
This is Science in a Minute.
Recent reports have suggested that drinking a glass of wine may be beneficial to your health. Researchers have found that wine has a concentration of a type of antioxidant called polyphenols that can be good for heart, brain, and muscle health. Some studies have even found that it might be able to help fight cancer. Now, a new study published in the American Chemical Society's Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry proposes that drinking wine may also be good for oral health as well. The study authors found two polyphenols found in wine that were good at preventing bacteria that cause dental plaque, cavities, and periodontal disease from sticking to teeth and gum cells. The two wine polyphenols were identified as caffeic and p-cumeric acids. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, the art scene in the Democratic Republic of Congo is vibrant and flourishing, but talented local artists still struggle for international recognition. VOA's Anita Powell takes us to the studios of some of Kinshasa's top talents, including a 25-year-old art sensation.
Painter Eddie Kamwanga Ilunga says he is inspired by his country's vast cultural and mineral wealth, but also its painful colonial history. His works have been exhibited in South Africa, Europe, and the United States, as African art has risen in popularity. One of his pieces can fetch up to $30,000 at an international auction. While those prices make him one of Congo's highest paid artists, industry insiders say by international standards, his work only fetches average prices.
I think that one should know that the artists here from Africa are regarded differently on the international art scene, and I think it's a struggle of many artists in Africa to get the same recognition.
Sculptor Freddy Tsimba says one problem is the lack of support at home. His works, made of discarded items like bullet casings, keys, and spoons, are shown internationally, but get little notice in Congo. These original pieces and antique crafts sell for a song at the bustling Kinshasa art market. But high-end work is rare, says local art promoter Fabrice Bashonga.
Congolese art is going very cheap in the international market, mainly because of the lack of consideration locally by the local market.
Artist Vichwa Milambe Bondo has exhibited and lived around the world, but returned home despite the challenges. He works at this recently established incubator for young Congolese talent.
I said, okay, it's good for me to stay here. Why? Because we need to build art scene and to build, to make something sense and the people can buy artwork in Congo. And now these people start to buy, but it's a process, it's a big challenge. I think the really challenge is to be here.
The studio also features women artists.
It is not easy at all because the men, they push you around a bit from all sides, and especially in the Congolese art scene, the market is rather difficult. To get someone to help you show your talent or your work, they block your path. You are a bit pushed aside.
Younger artists also say they struggle to establish themselves.
Me, my biggest dream is that I would like for people to talk about Congolese art the way we talk about American art, the way we talk about German art, the way we talk about Belgian art. I would like for the Congolese artist to be able to rise on the international stage.
Congolese artists say they are hopeful. That bit by bit, stroke by stroke, and line by line, that dream will finally come into focus. Anita Powell, VOA News, Kinshasa.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. You can thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In November 2013, the Ukrainian people came together on Kiev's Central Square, or Maidan, to demand that their voices be heard. After 3 months of protests, President Viktor Yanukovych, who had attempted to distance the country from Europe and join more closely to Russia against people's will, fled Ukraine. The heroes of the Euromaidan won their battle but inherited a country where corrupt entrenched interests had long prevented reform. Working through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, the Department of State, and implementing partners, the U.S. government has worked closely with Ukrainian civil society and the government of President Petro Poroshenko to set Ukraine on the road of fulfilling the promise of Euromaidan, a stable, democratic, prosperous, and free Ukraine, a Ukraine where robust rule of law and low levels of corruption attract the domestic and foreign investment necessary to ensure economic success. But this is not a simple proposition and cannot happen without a number of difficult reforms. While much has been achieved over the past 4 years, there is still much to be done. For this reason, Susan Fritz, USAID Regional Mission Director for Ukraine and Belarus, recently declared in a blog post that change is underway. The justice sector and the healthcare system are being restructured, she wrote. However, continued efforts to address corruption, including through the establishment of a truly independent anti-corruption court, are key to solidifying justice sector reform. Decentralization is bringing government resources closer to citizens, and newly consolidated communities are working to make government services more efficient and accountable, Fritz wrote. E-governance is helping automate government systems to provide transparency and accountability to government processes. Energy sector reform and the restructuring of the energy supply system, once completed, will provide the country with more energy independence and security, she wrote. While Ukraine has quite a ways to go before it can declare success in its reforms process and victory over corruption, we believe we've helped make considerable inroads, Fritz wrote. Our goal at USAID is unwavering, Fritz emphasized, to continue partnering with the government of Ukraine, the private sector, and civil society to stem corruption, deepen democracy, and stimulate inclusive economic growth. We are committed to making Ukraine self-reliant and helping Ukrainians attain the prosperity they desire and deserve.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.